Our economy is booming like never before. Jobless claims are at a 50-year low. The stock market is at an all-time high. Think of that. Over 50% since my election. 50%. People, the 401Ks, and they have 401Ks, and they were dying with them for years. Now they're so happy.
President Trump in the Rose Garden this morning touting the new North American trade deal, and everything is awesome. The Dow jumping nearly 300 points as it looks like trade war fears won't be hanging over the market any longer. But wait a second.
Whoa, that's right.
A number of groups closing at the lows of the day. Small caps selling off, the KRE, the regional banking ETF, closing at its lowest level of the year. And even the airlines are tumbling on higher oil prices. So was today's rally really not as awesome as it may have seemed, Guy?
You know, the S&P closes within half a percent of an all-time high. I think the all-time high in the S&P was 2940 or so. We're 16 handles or so away from that. Everything the president said is factually true, except
We're not up 50%. Except we're up 40%.
46%,
yeah, 46,
I think.
46.
It's close enough.
Anyway,
it's a big rally,
whether it be 40 or 50%.
So it's up 46%.
The part about people dying with their 401ks, that's a bit of hyperbole. But let me say this. Everything's great. VIX is at 12. Doesn't seem a lot of fear out there. KRE, you mentioned, small bank ETF. This is the lowest levels we've seen since last October. The Russell's rolling over is a bit of a concern. Obviously, things that are going on in Europe concern me. But with the S&P, you know, who's to argue the fact that the S&P goes up seemingly every day? The internals aren't great, but the market structure seems to be intact.
Well, you got to look at why they were rolling over. So if the Russell, what made the Russell outperform? Weaker dollar, or I should say stronger dollar, in trade.
Right.
Both of those are gone. So why wouldn't it roll over now?
So everything is awesome.
Why do small cap companies do worse in the trade environment? I thought these were local companies. These were small U.S. businesses that benefit.
Yes.
They're not subject to tariffs.
They're not subject to all the bad trade environment. So if the trade environment gets better, you would think that they would do worse, because then money rushes into large cap that's more dependent.
Didn't the trade environment get better today? And they were down 1.5%.
Yes, the trade environment got better, so the small cap should be down. Because the trading...
Theoretically, they should be more insulated from trade war fears because they're not as subject to tariffs.
So they were getting pushed higher because they were the best game in town.
They were the best game in town.
Exactly, right. All right, okay.
Everything is awesome when you're part of a team.
You didn't see the dollar make new highs. So it wasn't as if the dollar came in, but it didn't make new highs.
What do you think, Karen?
Well, for me, trade has really been at the very top of my list of worries. So I'm very happy to see a trade deal. I think that we sort of were getting a sense that things were heading the right way, I think, on Friday, and that maybe there could be a deal. So it wasn't such a big surprise to the upside, but that's important to me. The thing that I think made the market sort of start to roll over was energy prices really starting to move, which Tim has been on for a long time. And that starts to get into the inflation concern, right? So you saw TBT trade up, or the 10-year, for example, 308, now 307, 308. And then anything that was sensitive, airlines getting hurt, that's a little bit of concern for me. Wage pressure is there, too. All that, I think that bodes okay for the consumer. I think we have, you know, very high employment. Wage pressure is good because they're going to be making more money. But it concerns me for some of the other things, the oil and inflation. However, for banks, I think it's good.
Well, look, if you look at the correlation between oil prices and bond yields, we've seen this a couple different times. And, yeah, I think it's inflationary, although, you know, the consumer didn't benefit. You know, we have to look at this the same way reflexively. We weren't giving the consumer a lot of credit when oil's at 25 bucks. So I don't think that oil prices, which are up 20% since mid-August, which is extraordinary if you think about it, is something that's going to derail this economy. What's going to derail this economy is a trade deal with Canada is not a trade deal with China. And let's be clear about this. I mean, you know, the U.S. caught China very flat-footed in terms of this trade deal. By the way, they were tightening credit at the same time. We've really put them on their heels. China has the ability, I think, to hold through this in many different ways, including they have the ability to have monetary policy stimulate their economy if they really need to. So I look at PMIs last night. European PMIs are down 9 of 10 months. They're basically where they were in 2016 before we got into this global reflation time. So if you want to be worried about the global economy, I think there's enough data out there to say not that it's about to fall into the abyss, But that, yes, I think
if anything, the global economy should be bought on a relative basis. People want to move back into EM at this point because there's been such that stark outperformance. Not to say that it's going to come at the expense of the S&P, but maybe you'll just see some rotation.
We haven't mentioned in this whole period of time, 5 minutes into the show, the Fed raising interest rates and whether or not that could be a big headwind, particularly when you're talking about rotating into emerging markets. At a time when interest rates are rising, that's not necessarily
the trade. And they're doing what they should be doing. I think we all agree that the Fed should be raising, but I do think it's going to create a head. We, 6 months ago, 10-year trading above 3% was a huge burden for the market. Now, Karen brought it up, otherwise we wouldn't have been talking about it right now. I still think that's a concern. I'll say this, first day of the month, first day of a new quarter, with this trade deal in tow, I thought the S&P could have been up 35, 40 handles. Historically, we would have seen something like that. So to answer your original question, I don't think today's performance was all that great. With that said, how can you deny the fact that here we are effectively at all-time highs and everything?
I just get the sense that this market, though, you could make an argument that that was the least popular third quarter, which was the best quarter we've had since 2013 in a massive bull market, and nobody paid attention to it. It was up 7.8%, and I know we don't look back on this show, but I think the same sentiment exists now. People are very uncomfortable with the dynamics, and including, I've made the point that I think maybe we are front-loading some of this growth right now because I don't think there's any chance that the trade stuff as it sits right now will not affect growth in the fourth quarter.
So I like, valuation. And so we're sort of in a no-man's land until probably 10, 12 days from now. Then we'll start to see some numbers. That's what I think could put a floor, or not, it doesn't need a floor. I think that could give us more upside.
But what sectors do we want to be in the last quarter of the year? Do we want to be in, let's say, healthcare, which was the top performing sector in the third quarter?
I think so, yeah, and we've talked about that for a while. I think healthcare is sort of the under the radar. It's becoming now, more people are talking about it, but it's been under the radar. And you look at, for example, I think your final trade last week was Pfizer, and that stock's performed extraordinarily well ever since President Trump put a bullseye on their back 3 or 4 months ago. So I still think healthcare, in terms of valuation and in terms of the fact that nobody's really focused on it, still is in play.
Healthcare, tech, consumer discretionary.
Tech, still tech. The news sector tech, not communication services.
Yeah, it might be a little bit of both because they're both there. Because communication services are actually your new discretionary, basically, when you get the Netflix there. So even though Amazon is left behind, I think it's Amazon, I think it's Netflix, and I do think it's still Apple, and I do think it's healthcare as well.
All right. Despite today's rally, our next guest says there is limited upside left for this bull run. Let's bring in Mike Wilson, Chief U.S. Equity Strategist at Morgan Stanley. What are you worried about, Mike?
Well, I'm not really worried. I'm not hand-wringing over this, but you mentioned the right thing, Karen. The rates now are 310, okay? That was not the case, 6 months ago, and so that does put valuation constraint. We think 16 and a half times is kind of it. That's about as high as you can go when rates are at 310. That would be slightly below where we're trading today on a forward 12-month basis in terms of where earnings are, 173. The difference between now and a year ago is that a year ago, we still had tax to look forward to. We still had a lot of this leverage in the earnings model to look forward to. Today, we don't. So if we're at 173 on a forward 12-month basis, next year is 178. We think 178 is too high already. That means so 175 is kind of your number. You don't have the earnings upside you do over the next 12 months. So what are we playing for at this point? You're just kind of moving the chairs around. Yeah, you can rotate around. But, what's really interesting to me is the internals have been lousy, right, guy? But, that's because the market's confused. It's looking for new leadership here. I do like healthcare. Healthcare has the sort of, both the growth properties and some of the defensive properties that we've been favoring this year. So you can find some names in there. Even within tech, there's still good names. It's just not as broad, okay? The banks are probably the one thing that worries me the most, to be honest. You ask what worries me? The way the banks trade is telling me that growth is going to be even worse next year than what we're forecasting.
You mentioned the valuation of the overall market is pretty full right now. When you take a look at a sector like, let's say, healthcare is almost in line with the broader markets at this point. So how do you view valuations when you're looking at the sectors that you like?
Yeah, so healthcare is probably the most diverse sector out there. You have, value stocks and, growth stocks. You run the gamut. So on average, it's about average because it looks like the market in many ways. So I don't think healthcare is nearly as cheap as it was. Some of these issues around drug pricing, those concerns have taken a back seat, and that's really helped healthcare here in the short term. But it's a stock-picking game. At least you can find names within healthcare that can grow, okay? And they're somewhat defensive because I am worried a little bit about the deceleration that we're going to see next year, both economically and from an earnings growth standpoint.
Mike, what are you doing with energy, especially oil prices, which at this point, even just technically, they're at an average price now that people have to be pushing up estimates for a lot of the big integrators?
We like energy a lot. That's been our favorite sector for most of this year because it has defensive properties. That sounds kind of weird. It's a cyclical group, but it has defensive properties because of some of those yields.
Yep.
We're going to get big revisions in the October reporting season because the earnings move or the oil price move has been dramatic, and that's not baked into the numbers. So on a relative earnings revision basis over the next 4 weeks, I think energy's got to be in the portfolio.
Mike, so what we see going into year end is a chase for performance, and with the average hedge fund somewhere around up 3%, where do you see the chase for performance coming in to your premise?
Well, look, you mentioned the three sectors that have really outperformed this year, tech, consumer discretionary, and healthcare. Those are going to get a bid because that's what people own, right? So people like to chase kind of what they own. They're comfortable with the names. But I do think this rotation towards defensively oriented sectors has happened since June. We're going to see more of that as well. So in other words, you're going to get chasing in areas that people don't own because they're going to work. But I think what they're going to want to buy are the things that have worked all year. And that's typically what most active managers do. They chase the things that have been working this year until they stop. Now, I mentioned earlier that the breadth of the technology sector has been pretty weak over the last 4 to 5, 6 weeks. I think we're going to see more names kind of fall off in October. And I think that's what portfolio managers should be really focused on right now. Make sure that what you do have in the portfolio today is something you feel very good about going through earnings season with.
You mentioned the 10-year yield at 3.10s or thereabouts at this point. Are you worried about inflation in and of itself, or are you only worried about the yield in relationship to the valuation of stocks?
Well, it depends on what kind of inflation we're getting, right? So, you know, good inflation, meaning costs are going up to offset some of these increases in input costs, is healthy. That's a bull market. But what I am worried about is energy costs. That's not healthy, generally. Energy, you know, things that can disrupt the consumer, prices that can't be passed on necessarily in the supply chain, freight costs, tariffs. I mean, I don't think the tariff, by the way, I don't think tariffs is resolved because we got this deal with Mexico and Canada. The big one's always been about China. So I think that's going to come back into play after the midterms. And I think that is the biggest risk for next year is tariffs and margins. We think even without tariffs going up next year, that margins is going to be the story in 2019 that's disappointing. That's where the biggest risk is on earnings.
Quickly, you mentioned China. How is the market underestimating the resolve of the Chinese?
Well, look, the Chinese can play long ball, right? I mean, I think they can take a lot of pain. I think there's no incentive for the Chinese, in my view, to negotiate now, right? Let's wait and see what happens with the election, see how, you know, tough the president wants to be post the midterm, see how it turns out, right? I think the Chinese probably quietly are hoping for a correction in the stock market, quite frankly, because maybe that will get the administration to kind of come to the table a bit more. Look, I think that President Trump has shown a penchant to want to go the distance on this. And I think it's, you know, it's going to get scary again. Let's put it that way. I don't know where it ends up, but I think it's going to get scary again. And right now, it doesn't seem that scary from an investor perspective at the moment.
Mike, thank you. Good to see you. Mike Wilson of Morgan Stanley. Karen, are you with Mike in terms of limited upside here?
Well, I think his job is to sort of make market calls, right, which I feel like is the opposite of my job. It scares me a little when you know, he talks about the multiple, whatever. I do think the markets tend to, they don't stop on a dime of valuation of, here's the correct valuation. They go too far one way or another, and I'm suspecting we will go too far to the upside. Mm.
So just, you know, I brought up energy because I really love the integrateds here, and if you read a lot of the good reports out there, you can see that valuations on a price to free cash flow relative to their history, people like Chevron, Royal Dutch, are very, very cheap. I think this is a place you can continue to play, and I like the yield basis as well, even though people think yields are going higher.
You know, Mike was worried about growth sort of being pulled forward or growth out of the picture, or it's going to be less than what it is now. Then that means that the Fed should probably sit back. He was also worried about interest rates. So maybe the Fed sits back if growth isn't as great and rates come in a little bit, and maybe that salvages the rally.
Sits back
that
when in 2019?
Well, we're seeing it right now. He's worried about it right now. So
okay,
I still think the Fed is going to, well, I mean, I still think the Fed moves at least three times next year, but that's what makes markets. And again, going back to the original conversation, I think there's still some runway in healthcare. Maybe it is starting to get a little expensive, but I think there'll be catch up into the end of the year in the healthcare sector.
Coming up, Teflon Tesla, the stock soaring back today as Elon Musk strikes a deal with the SEC. Is this just more proof you can't bet against Musk? Plus, GE lighting up today after a shakeup in the C-suite. But is this stock a value trade or a value trap?
Boom.
The chairwoman, Karen Finerman's got three things to look for. And attention, crypto universe, the chairman of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Chris Giancarlo, is here to talk all things Bitcoin and regulation right after this break. And for all you Ether fans, you want to stay tuned. We are live from Times Square in New York City. Much more Fast Money right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. If Bitcoin is a commodity, how would you classify some of the other cryptocurrencies? CNBC's Bob Pisani is in Washington sitting down with the man who regulates it all, CFTC Chair Chris Giancarlo. Bob, take it away.
Thanks very much, Melissa. Mr. Giancarlo, thanks very much for joining us. Fast Money viewers love hearing about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. You're the man in charge of regulating that, but there's a lot of questions about regulation. There was a roundtable last week held in Washington to look at better ways to protect consumers from crypto fraud and to regulate cryptos more effectively. What do you need to do to make sure the crypto market is regulated so that average Americans can invest in it?
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be with you.
Thank you.
And we're very focused on the fraud and manipulation aspects of cryptocurrency markets right now. And in fact, last week, we just won a big victory in a federal court in Boston, certifying our authority to prosecute fraud and manipulation in the crypto space. We've been very active at it.
Do you worry that if the U.S. futures, the U.S. does not do more to innovate, that the crypto innovation is going to go overseas? This is a complaint that the crypto bulls constantly push against us. The U.S. has got to go ahead with this or it's going to go offshore. Yeah.
And yet, it's the United States that's gone forward with the very first Bitcoin derivatives, with Bitcoin futures trading on the CME and also Bitcoin options and Bitcoin clearing. We're ahead of the world in that. So there's no question that the United States is leading in a number of areas. But there's other areas as well of innovation where I think it makes sense for us to take a little bit more of a thoughtful and intelligent approach, just as the U.S. Congress did 20 years ago in the early days of the Internet.
You know, viewers constantly ask me about the difference between the CFTC, for example, and the SEC. Now, we know, of course, that Bitcoin is a commodity. You regulate that as the CFTC. But Bitcoin ETFs are a security.
Yes.
And the SEC regulates that. Now, the SEC has been very reticent to agree to a Bitcoin ETF, and yet we have Bitcoin futures trading. Can you briefly explain? It looks to viewers like it's safe to trade Bitcoin futures, but wait, it's not safe to have a Bitcoin ETF. How do you explain that disparity?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're old agencies. Our statutes were written in the 1930s. So we're operating off a 30-year piece of, you might call it, software we're trying to repurpose for a new innovation that didn't exist when these statutes were written. More broadly, the SEC, their oversight is over capital formation markets with a big retail focus. Our, at the CFTC, our focus is on risk transfer markets, and we've always focused on derivatives. And a lot of that is institutional trading. So we're focused on institutional investment. They're focused on retail. Different orientation, different history. So we do come at these things from different perspectives.
So where do we go from here? Where do you see the Bitcoin market evolving? Go out your crystal ball 2 years from now. What do you see happening?
Well, so I personally think that cryptocurrencies are here to stay. I think there is a future for them. I'm not sure they ever come to rival the dollar or other hard currencies, but there's a whole section of the world that really is hungry for functioning currencies that they can't find in their local currencies. There's 140 countries in the world. Every one of them has a currency. Probably two-thirds of them are not worth the polymer or the paper they're written on, and those parts of the world rely on hard currencies. Bitcoin may solve some of the problems, whether it's Bitcoin or another cryptocurrency, but we're talking not 2 years. We're talking maybe 10
so
years down the road.
That innovation. You're sounding like an innovative guy. How do you push that innovation and protect mom and pop out there from getting ripped off? Well, we know it's a problem. We know custody's a problem. We know fraud's a problem. Yeah.
So it's this two-handed approach. On one hand, we're real strong and hard against fraud manipulation. On the other hand, we're innovative and thoughtful when it comes to innovation. And just this very week, we're kicking off our very first and the very first for any U.S. government agency fintech conference here in Washington.
Before I let you go, I got to ask about another hot topic, marijuana. Pot stocks. Marijuana is becoming legal. It's not fully legal in the United States, of course, right, but it's becoming legal. Could you foresee the day when the CFTC might approve a marijuana futures trading contract?
I could foresee the day. It would rely on, just as you said, working our way through the legality of marijuana. But as a legal product, I could absolutely see something based upon a marijuana as a derivative product.
Now, that will be something we will cover. I can assure you.
I'll look forward to it.
Will you come back and explain more about what you're doing?
Indeed.
The viewers are really interested in what you have to say about this.
Thank you, Bob.
Chris Giancarlo, thank you very
My
much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Chris Giancarlo is the chairman of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Melissa, back to you.
All right, Bob. Bob Pisani, lots to unpack there. But first of all, I want to touch on this the notion of a marijuana contract. This seems to imply that all marijuana is created equal, and that's really not the case when it comes to particularly medicinal versus recreational use.
Yeah,
marijuana.
And again, sorry to do this, but let's call it cannabis. And ultimately, you can't have a commodity based upon the underlying plant. I mean, you just, you know, there's just, to me, and the whole story behind cannabis is that this is not about necessarily the plant that sells as a commodity. This is about all the derivative usage and all the medical, and yes, recreationally, but it's the same thing. Do we have an alcohol, you know, contract? I mean, you know, what, you know, ultimately,
but we have
that's
corn,
really where
we have soybeans, we have crude. I mean,
but,
just to play devil's advocate, isn't
anybody,
that the same?
It's not, because again, it's really about the derivative products. And I would go right back to if the recreational side of cannabis is a substitution for what's going on in the food and the alcohol world. Are we dealing with the CFTC there? I don't think we would be. And I think it's ultimately about brands. It's ultimately about the products that are going to be created from this, the lifestyle, the opportunities. And
it is interesting, though, when you look at a Bitcoin, because we're talking about the two of them overlaid. It's interesting when you look at a Bitcoin chart and then you overlay it with a Tilray or a Canopy or a Cronos. It's sort of a similar buyer that's out there. It has nothing to do with each other, but yet guys are looking for outer limits of the risk spectrum, and it seems like there's inverse correlation.
Markets, less than liquid markets with a lot of retail investors and a parabolic move. Any chart looks the same, I don't think you're doing this, Steve, but yeah, I think they're totally different.
Totally different.
In terms of stocks, though, real quick, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, listen, Bitcoin probably doesn't even make a dent in their revenues, but you have some optionality if, in fact, one day it is big. And you look at it, August contracts were up 18% over July. So the growth in CME continues to be there. Valuation is a concern. They report the end of October. But Chicago Mercantile Exchange, within a whisper of its all-time high, I think continues to go higher here.
If there's a Bitcoin ETF, Karen, do you think that would be a catalyst for Bitcoin?
Definitely. I do. I mean, I think there's so much money that just says, I got to wait till this is a little further along in its evolution of being a tradable security.
All right, still ahead. Netflix reportedly looking to customize some of its original content with Choose Your Own Adventure programming, so the traders are choosing their own adventures when it comes to the stock. I'm Melissa Lee. You're watching Fast Money on CNBC, First in Business Worldwide. In the meantime, here's what else is coming up on Fast.
Not in the last 18 years, which has seen GE lose $500 billion in market cap. But Kay Fine says there are three signs that could mark a bottom. She will break it down. Plus,
it's
going
to be like pretty weird.
It was pretty weird. But now that Elon is here to stay, the traders tell you the one thing the company needs to do to get back in high gear. And that's when Fast Money returns.
Welcome back to Fast Money. It's out with the not-so-old, in with the very new at GE, the company ousting relative newcomer CEO John Flannery, replacing him with Larry Culp. The stock surged about 10% off the news. So who is Larry Culp? Why are investors so excited? Right. Making its Fast Money debut is CNBC's Frank Holland. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Thanks a lot, Melissa. I appreciate it. You know, legendary. That's how an analyst from Melius described Larry Culp to me. Others just as generous with their praise for the new GE CEO, but they're also a bit cautious, pointing out there's a lot of work to be done to get this company back on track and in a time frame that satisfies investors and analysts. Culp was the CEO of Danaher from 2001 to 2014. During that time, the company handily outperformed the S&P. The market cap also increased by more than $46 billion. John Eade of Arcus Research called Culp's leadership of Danaher a model of consistency, citing double-digit revenue growth and margin improvement. There's also a consensus that Culp will be more aggressive and have more of a sense of urgency than former CEO John Flannery did. A word that keeps coming up is outsider, in a good way. But Culp actually joined the GE board this year. Jeffrey Sonnenfeld of the Chief Executive Leadership Institute told me he's confident Culp and new lead director Thomas Horton will bring reinvention to GE.
The positive is we have a fantastic team coming on board that the market seems to appreciate their communication skills. But strategically, I don't think there's anything wrong with the path they were on, other than the fact that you might almost argue, and people are going to blow up on this, they're moving too fast.
Well, but Gautam Khanna of Cowen says investors should expect urgency and action. Even with that, analysts feel it'll take a change in culture and possibly organization to improve the stock price. Melissa?
All right. Frank, thank you. Frank Holland, back at headquarters. Well, it's not just lights out for Flannery. The lights had actually gone dim on GE for a long, long time. Since the stock hit its all-time high back in August 28, 2000, GE has lost almost half a trillion dollars. Yep, you heard me right. Half a trillion dollars in market cap. That is more than the market cap of two Boeings put together. GE has also plunged 80% since then. This while the overall market has almost doubled and hit record high. So now with GE falling so far from its heyday back in 2000, you might be wondering if the stock is a value trade or a value trap and what the difference is. Karen's going to answer that for us in a segment we like to call The More You Know. Karen.
Okay, so GE, this is a difficult one, but let's go through some of the aspects of this and see where they lay out. So the first thing for me, value trade or value trap, always, let's look at valuation. GE is a very cheap valuation on a PE multiple, both to the market and to its own historical PE. Not as quite cheap on some of the other metrics beside PE, but let's give them that cheap valuation. On the other side, the flip side, the balance sheet, right? A lot of debt in this company. So that goes definitely in the value trap side. And here's where it gets a little bit murkier. GE has a number of businesses that are in different strategic positions and have facing some different headwinds and tailwinds. I like the aviation business a lot. That's on the positive side. So let's put that over on sector growth. And I also like healthcare. And we'll see a spinoff in healthcare. So that's going to be coming up sometime in the next, I don't know, maybe 18 months. And then competitive position, I think we need to leave these two, slowing revenue and competitive position, sort of in the middle. They've got power and renewables has really been sort of a headwind, more than a headwind, disaster for them. On the other side, so that stays there. Slowing revenue for those businesses is going to stay there. We have sector growth for the other two. So when I put that all together, trying to take away any of the history of GE and just looking at it right now, putting it all together, I lean slightly toward the value trade. And the way I would do it is a January of 2020 call, the 13 strike at $1.38 was the last trade. I would buy that for the turnaround. I know exactly what I'm going to lose. I don't need to worry about how do I trade around it. And ultimately, you could end up making a lot of money on it, or you certainly could lose everything, but I know exactly how much that is. So that's how I come out just slightly on the value trade for GE.
Questions for Karen.
So, Steve. Karen, real quick, when value trade and value trap, they can turn into one another. So how long do you give it? I know your options trade is priced out, but realistically, with the stock, how long do you give Culp?
I think, well, he's a great CEO. That's an outstanding choice. I think you need to give him 6 months. Although I do think if the stock breaks 10 before that, then sort of all bets are off. But 6 months at least. I'm surprised they gave Flannery as little time as they did. So 6 months, let's say.
Keying off of that, you know, the analyst over at J.P. Morgan, Steve Tusa, who's been sort of the axe in the space when it comes to GE, said that the timing and the format of the change
concerns them.
Concerns him.
Yeah, that there's something
more of a negative, that there might be something behind
Well, that they're
this.
Rushing this one, you know,
right.
Although, you know, after 14 months, we, you know, with all due respect to Mr. Flannery, this wasn't going anywhere and that it was time for actually shaking up a culture that wasn't working. I read that note. It's a good note. Citi's actually out there with a buy. I think the bottom line is, I think the bad news, and Karen points out the balance sheet, but I think a lot of it's on the table. Short base is gone. Long base is empty. I think there's upside.
Yeah, I think you got to give GE credit real quick. The fact maybe they said, you know, we have a problem here, and they addressed it instead of staying with something maybe longer than they should have. And you talk about Culp. I mean, he was at Danaher, 37 years old, one of the great companies that acquires and integrates companies better than maybe any company out there. You have to say to yourself, maybe this is a guy they should have hired in the first place 14 months ago. Yep.
All right, still ahead, Tesla taking investors on a wild ride, soaring today after CEO Elon Musk reached an agreement with the SEC. Is it safe to buy this volatile stock? Plus, it's choose your own adventure, Netflix style. What is the biggest threat to the streaming giant? Where do the traders see it going? Find out when Fast Money returns. Welcome back to Fast Money. Shares of Tesla kicking into high gear today after CEO Elon Musk struck a deal with the SEC over the weekend. For more details, let's get to Phil LeBeau in Chicago with the latest. Phil.
Melissa, the most important thing that you need to remember if you are an investor in Tesla is that Elon Musk, with this deal with the SEC, he remains CEO. And that's separate from all the other agreements that were made here, including the fact that Tesla has to add two new independent directors to the board of directors, that Elon Musk has to give up the chairmanship for at least 3 years, and that his communications have to be monitored by some type of a committee that'll be formed by the Tesla board of directors. So they'll be checking his communications, particularly Twitter, but all communications. And speaking of communications, Tesla filed an 8K regarding a leaked email from Elon Musk over the weekend regarding Model 3 production. That's interesting because we've never seen Tesla file an 8K before. Look, they may have in the past whenever he issued something on Twitter, but generally speaking, whatever he said, it went out there and we didn't always see an 8K filing. So perhaps they've gotten a little bit of religion following the agreement with the SEC. In that email that Elon Musk sent out over the weekend, it was regarding Model 3 production. He sent it to employees at Tesla, and he essentially said, look, if we go all out tomorrow, we will achieve an epic victory beyond all expectations. What's that epic victory? Possibly profitability. The street is expecting Tesla to produce in the third quarter Model 3, 52,000, roughly speaking. On Model S and X, if you put those together, the expectation is somewhere around 25,000. Combine all of that, about 77,000, 78,000. We expect those numbers to come out over the next couple of days. And Melissa, if they hit those Model 3 numbers, and let's say it's 53,000 or 54,000, they exceed the expectation, there's a pretty good chance that they will either indicate or make it very clear that they expect profitability in the third quarter. Melissa, back to you.
They'll indicate that through their release of the deliveries, or will they file another 8K?
I think a lot of us were, our eyes went like this. We went, whoa,
yeah, exactly.
Okay, so maybe things are changing here a little bit. I mean, it's a small thing, but it's one of those things that people are looking at and saying, are they going to start to rein in some of the tweets? And look, Melissa, if you look at the end of last quarter, Elon Musk was the one who said, hey, we did 7,000 Model 3s in 7 days.
Yeah.
And it was a tweet. There was no 8K filing. It was a tweet from him.
That's right.
I think we're not going to hear that anymore.
All right. Phil, thanks. Phil LeBeau in Chicago. So after today's move, is it safe to say you cannot bet against Elon Musk? And Karen and I were discussing the price action in the green room, how it's fascinating that the stock went right
back to the level.
Prior to the SEC lawsuit. And what does that tell you? If it goes right
fish
back
market.
To the level and there's nothing more added for improved corporate governance, for monitoring of his tweets, for a new chairman of the board, nothing. Nothing in addition.
Well, but I could come back and say there's nothing in there for potential DOJ or class action suits or the fact that, you know, the, one of those tweets or one of those letters that was in, circulated internally said we're close to profitability. Bulls hear one thing, bears hear another. And I think you have a company still with an enormous amount of risk around it. You know, it doesn't mean that this wasn't great news. And I applaud Elon Musk for finding it in his, you know, in his being to go down a road that he had to do.
Karen.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, if you're in the stock and you believe Elon, is, you have to have Elon to be in the stock, I think this is more than a net, a bit of a net positive because, just as Tim said, you saw Elon either being disciplined and doing what he had to do, or else you saw somebody else telling Elon, this is what you have to do and you're going to do it. I don't care whether you like it. Either of those, I think, are good,
scenario.
For Elon staying in the CEO role.
You think
so
the company's
good.
In a better place than they were before this announcement?
Before Friday.
Forget the SEC.
Yes.
Before the SEC came in and announced their charges and had a settlement. So where we were 2 weeks ago, wherever we were.
No, that was Thursday, I think, or Wednesday.
It was Thursday.
So I think that that he turned down this original settlement is astounding to me. That, I mean, that was ridiculous. It's the easiest case the SEC, I think, that I've ever seen. So, you know, he had a trade down just to hear. I think this is a little bit better. He got it together.
Then why doesn't the stock price reflect the fact that the company or the belief
so
that
much
the company
unknown.
Is
it's still Elon
de-risk.
Musk? How much did he?
Right.
How much did he do just to get through? Yeah, exactly. I think that you still have holders that are lightening up on their positions, and I don't think that they're going to buy right back in. These are large top 10 holders mm-hmm. that I don't think anything has changed substantially to them.
Friday we did this show, and I thought you know the fact that he didn't take that deal,
yeah.
this stock was headed low 200s. For certain, without question. And then this, you know, I don't know what happened over the weekend. Maybe somebody told him what he potentially was facing and he didn't want to be the next Martha Stewart. Doesn't really matter. But to your point, it's back where we started from. Sometimes you get into a stock, you're involved in a stock when you zig in it, you should zag. And that's the way I feel right now with Netflix, with Tesla. So I don't know what to do here, to be quite honest with you.
So when you say zig when you should zag, what
well,
is it doing
right
now?
And what would
the opposite?
It's going up and it goes down. Okay. You've been bullish on the stock,
so this doesn't change your outlook on a company that you think is a great long-term.
Yeah, the stock was getting priced in without Elon Musk, and now he's back.
Let's just think about that, though, for a second. I was, like, a little bit surprised by the settlement this morning, and I shouldn't have been. It was so obvious. I shouldn't have been that surprised. So maybe the market was saying, all right, maybe he set. It ended up at, what, 270, let's say, on Friday. Maybe that was pricing in 220 if he's gone and 310 if he's back. Not that he was gone.
Right.
Okay. For more on what Wall Street is saying about Tesla, you can head over to tradingnation.cnbc.com. There's a great story up right now you want to check out. Coming up on Fast, one of the biggest gaming events of the year happening in New York over the weekend. We'll give you an inside look at the action. Sit down with the so-called godfather of esports. We're live at the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. Much more Fast Money right after this.
Mel.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see it. I was enthralled in this Choose Your Own Adventure book. If you were born before 1980, you may recall these were the stories that you could choose how the book ended. Well, fast forward to today, and there's a report that Netflix subscribers may soon be able to do just that. Choose the next storyline in a TV show or a movie. Now, Netflix has experimented with this interactive content before in children's programming, but is now targeting adults. Sci-fi fans of the show Black Mirror can expect to choose their own ending in one episode before the end of this year. Now, Netflix shareholders have been on quite the adventure this year, as the stock has rallied almost 100% since January. So we thought we could play our own Choose Your Own Netflix adventure, right? Yeah. What's next for Netflix, and where will the stock be trading 1 year from now?
Huh.
All right, so we're going to... Guy, we're going to kick it off with you.
I don't know
the
why they do that, because it takes me time to figure this out.
Choose your own Netflix,
October 1st, right. 2019.
Where's the stock going to be? Yeah.
Is that a book?
Yes.
Space and Beyond.
Yes, is what it says.
Yeah.
So this is my adventure I'm choosing.
Yeah. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yes. So Google,
Netflix,
I don't want your adventure.
Netflix closed today at $385. I say this time next year, it's $450. Mm. And since it's my adventure, not anybody else's adventure.
Yours alone.
Why wouldn't Google or Alphabet buy Netflix? Think about it. 90% of their revenues derive from search business. They could diversify away. A nice sort of attach on to a YouTube thing. It's not crazy. Now, with that said, it's over a $200 billion deal. Probably not going to happen. But in my world, alternate reality, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think that's nuts.
The size of the deal?
Look, guys, fantasy world is fantasy, all right? There's no way Google's going after it and pay $250 when YouTube is undervalued right now. And I think Google certainly has a gem on their hands here. Again, you know how I feel about Netflix and its valuation. I think there's a ton of competition.
We'll get to your adventure soon enough, buddy.
Sorry, well, mine's a nightmare.
But I do like his price target. His price target, I think, is on point.
All right, okay. It's Karen's turn to choose her own Netflix adventure.
I'm sorry. It's really not an adventure. It's just not that exciting at all. I see it at, like, $350 or so. Competition has kind of creeped up on them.
Who's the competition?
Costs are rising. GE? No, GE is not the competition. The competition is Disney sure hopes it's Disney, right? There's a lot of others that hope, Amazon hopes they're the competition, but I think that's going to start to weigh on Disney.
That's no adventure.
It's not that adventuresome. Like, I know. I don't want to make up a...
That's like one of those boring, like Staten Island ferry rides or something.
Like the Hall of Presidents at Disney World, which happens to be my favorite ride.
Hall of Presidents. It's not a ride. It's an exhibit. Let's get that straight.
We're doing it wrong. Hall of Presidents.
Yeah. That was good.
Yeah. All right. Brasso's turn. Right. Choose your own adventure.
This is an adventure. I think I'm beginning to see how the desk is setting up here. So I would think that Amazon's their biggest competitor. And they always say Amazon should buy CBS to compete with Netflix.
You always say that?
Well, one guy already
says it. His adventure.
You say it?
He always says it.
Oh, he does.
So if Amazon's way to compete with Netflix is to buy CBS, maybe Netflix beats them to the punch and buys CBS. Ooh. And I put a $500 price target on mine.
You lured me in because I thought you were doing Amazon's going to take out Netflix. I was ready to rain on your parade. And I actually kind of like that.
You like that.
All right. Look, CBS needs a big brother. And I think the valuation right now is actually somewhat attractive.
Oh, that's ironic with their show. Good.
Well,
That's a good adventure. Steve has a nice
adventure. He goes higher than you.
He's got a nice imagination.
His adventure.
I'm your adventure. I'm long CBS. I would love your adventure to have.
See?
Yeah.
All right.
Shared adventure. Isn't that nice?
I'm going to stop now.
Tim, choose your own adventure.
Look, my adventure is that this is a 310 stock, so this stock's down 25%, and Hulu eats their lunch. That's my adventure.
Hulu. Of all the, competitors
Hulu,
out there,
I choose Hulu. Basically could be Amazon, could be Disney. All these guys are streaming. It's going to be a very competitive landscape in a year. Bye-bye.
That's not an adventure
at all. I'm with Steve's adventure. I'm ditching my own adventure.
Piling on.
Let's get to Micah, who always chooses his own adventure. He's out in San Francisco with some interesting options activity on Netflix that happened today. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. Yeah, so call volume outpaced put volume by about 2-1. That's consistent with what we've been seeing for the last 2 weeks. So bullish activity, and the most active were the weekly 385 calls, over 7,700 of which had traded at about $5.50, over 12,000 by the end of the day. So the options market still sees some room to run in Netflix.
All right, Mike, thanks for that. Mike Cohen, San Francisco. For more options action, you can check out the full show. That's Friday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern time. Still ahead, he's the so-called godfather of esports. Founder of the first North American gaming team. There he is, the man, the myth, the legend, Craig Levine. He will tell us the next big catalyst for the space when Fast Money returns. Welcome back to Fast Money. We all know that one of Karen's favorite things to do when she's not on this desk is collecting and looking at modern art. But did you know that just this past weekend she picked up a totally different hobby?
Esports.
Let's see what she was up to.
Wow.
We're here at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn for the ESL One New York Tournament, one of the premier Counter-Strike tournaments in the world. So actually, game day today. What happens in the morning? What time do they get up?
Today, they'll meet in the morning, and they're going to have a team meeting, and then it goes into breaks down into individual practice sessions.
So how hard does your team prepare, let's say, a month in advance for a big tournament like this?
Our preparation's constant, but I'd say we practice anywhere from 10 to 12 hours a day on an individual and team-based level. This is our life. It's what we love doing, and we put all of ourselves into it.
So when you're in a series like this, I know you try to take it one day at a time. How do you relax after this, and then how do you prepare for tomorrow?
I mean, we're really experienced. We've been doing this for years, some of us, and it's really easy to just go into the next series, and you have to just remember that every series is a new day. It's a different team, different maps, so everything could be different each and every day, so you have to be ready for that mentally.
Here to break down the esports hype is someone who's known to many as the godfather of esports. Craig Levine is a global chief strategy officer for ESL, formerly known as the Electronic Sports League. They're the biggest independent esports company in the world to organize the tournament you just saw. It's so great to have you with us. This is something that we've been talking about for so long. I'm curious because you've been in the business since, what, early 2000s?
Yeah, late 90s.
Why is it taking off now? Is it that streaming, that the technology, the ability to stream has finally caught up with the actual sport?
Yeah, over the last 10 years, the game business has fundamentally changed from an annual box release to now games as a service, microtransactions, ongoing monetization through the engagement and retention of their audience. So publishers are finding that esports is actually a tool to do just that and actually driving their business. Combined with that, the democratization of content, self-publishing, Facebook, Twitter, obviously Twitch and others, and all of a sudden our sport was able to really grow sort of bottom up into where it's come today. So I think those have been some of the key drivers over the last few years, and not to mention sort of 5 years ago when we took the leap and held our first esports event in an arena. The idea of tens of millions of people tuning in live over the internet suddenly became real. And for us, that was a real inflection point with what we've seen in the industry.
Sponsorships also is sort of a relatively new thing, which has sort of stabilized, I would think, or gave the impression that the sport is here to stay, that these leagues are here to stay, the tournaments are going to grow. Do the sponsors know what they're getting into at this point, or is this sort of, let's just throw money at this and see what happens?
Yeah, I think we're fortunately beyond that sort of test and see kind of phase of our business. There's great partners that we've had, like companies like Intel, for the last 15 years that have been investing into this, obviously very core to what they do. But now we're seeing companies like Mercedes and AT&T and even DHL stepping into this and recognizing there's a changing consumption habit with this whole generation, and this is how they need to be engaging with them to be relevant.
So you're an independent production company as opposed to one that's owned by a bigger company. How do you fit into this ecosystem?
Yeah, so it's our vision to build this global infrastructure of esports all over the world, from what we call zero to hero, from the first time you play the game to the biggest stages in the world. And games can come and go, and ultimately we want to create that infrastructure, that great IP that publishers have can plug into speed to market, great partnerships, and sort of take advantage of this vast network that we're building.
Craig, we hope you'll come back. It's fascinating stuff. Craig Levine, the Global Chief Strategy Officer for ESL. Final trades are up next. We've got breaking news on the planned Rockwell Collins United Technologies deal. Eric Chami's got all the details. Eric.
That's right, Melissa. The Justice Department is giving approval for the takeover of United Technologies buying Rockwell Collins under the stipulation that they sell two of their aerospace businesses. So that is just out. Reuters is reporting it. Of course, United Technologies stock up 20% since the deal was announced last year. Back to you, Melissa.
All right, Chami. Thanks, Eric Chami. Time for the final trade. Tim.
You know, we talked energy tonight, integrated oils. I love Chevron here on valuation alone.
Karen.
Yes, well, doing the value trade trap thing made me really think GE Leaps is the way to go. I know exactly what I'm going to risk. January 20th.
Leaps.
13 strike for me.
Grasso.
Electronic Arts. It's underperformed the space. I think it will outperform in the next 2 months.
Guy.
The way yields are moving, we mentioned Bitcoin being sort of the beta tail, but Chicago Mercantile Exchange is going higher here, I think, folks.
See you back here tomorrow at 5 for more Fast. Mad Money starts right now.